Welcome to Worlds Apart. Suppressing an issue in the hope that it will go away by itself is a common strategy for dealing with challenging and unpleasant realities, and sometimes it works, but clearly not in the case of Israel and Palestine. The decades-long procrastination at addressing the problem in an authentic and meaningful way has led to such an accumulation of rage and violence that the status quo seems no longer sustainable. Is there still a civil way out? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Amal Abu Zayd, former member of the Lebanese parliament and advisor to former Lebanese president Michel Aoun. Mr. Zayd, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Now, in my introduction, I just said that the status quo in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict seems no longer sustainable, but I wonder if you actually agree with that, with this latest eruption of violence. Do you think the problem can still be put on hold? That is, Israel retreating to its previous strategy of fortifying its own defenses and sealing off Gaza from the rest of the world and, frankly, from a dignified life?
Well, I think we have to, all of us, all concerned parties or people have to have this ability to say that the status quo has to be maintained. Otherwise, we will go to a full-fledged war, which nobody wants and nobody desires on both sides. But for this to happen, we have to look at the whole issue from a different perspective, if I may say, which means justice. I mean, we have to, Israel has to stop its arrogance and has to stop its way of disregarding the self-determination for the Palestinians. All over these years, 75 years already, they are deprived from their own national state. So once this has been addressed, accepted politically, diplomatically, I think everybody would be happy to see a solution, a peaceful solution, in spite for what's happening in Gaza.
But Mr. Zayd, I mean, as much as we all want that, I think the current status quo is based actually on implicit denial of the Palestinian rights and the Palestinian dignity, you know, normal life to millions of the Palestinian people. And I think it's fair to say that for many decades, keeping Gaza under blockade has been Israel's preferred strategy. That's essentially how they've been conducting their policy. If Israel indeed moves into Gaza, do you think they actually understand what they are going to encounter there? Do you think Israel is fully aware of what kind of consequences it will have to deal with?
I think till now they didn't take the final decision to enter into Gaza, to go for a full ground attack, because they should be aware, especially after what happened to them on the 7th of October. They were taken by surprise, and this surprise, they were not prepared for them. They were not prepared. They thought that everything is going to be according to their agenda, but things have changed. The Palestinians, they have changed. And as you just mentioned before, if we look at the status quo as it was before, just to keep denying the Palestinian rights of self-determination and to have their entire state with their sovereignty and so on. This means a continuity of extremism on both sides and continuity of war, because it will not stop by blockading Gaza, which they did for several years. What has changed? Nothing. It has increased. The people increased, gave Hamas and other groups inside this small part of the world of Palestine the reason to go to fight, go to arms and fight for their own rights. Mm-hmm. So I suspect that this time, if they don't think well, they will be paying a very high price.
Now, if we put aside the emotional and rhetorical and political reasons for the Netanyahu government, because to some extent they are wiping up this hysteria around the takeover of Gaza to cover for their own security failures, that's pretty clear. And I think even the Israeli media recognize that. But If we put all of that aside, it seems that the full-scale invasion of Gaza goes against Israel's interest, because, as you just said, it's impossible to even imagine what kind of consequences they will have to face, because, you know, 3 million people who are highly antagonistic towards Israel and are likely to remain so for many, many decades. Why do you think then the Israeli government is still stirring up this hornet's nest? Why do you think they're sort of telling the whole world that they are about to invade Gaza?
They have announced very high expectations. They wanted to attack Gaza, first of all, as they said, to finish with Hamas, and secondly, to maintain order and governance over there. But for this to happen, it means, as you just said, it means they have to exterminate or to finish with millions of people. See what's going on in Gaza these days. Daily bombardment by different types of weapons and from airplanes, from the sea, whatever. You just name it. And what's going on? More casualties, many children, women, civilians are being killed. And if they cannot achieve their demands or their expectations as a government in order to face, to save their faces. You know, Netanyahu is in deep political problem these days. And there was a division inside the Israeli community. You know, what happened after the 7, okay, they formed a unity government, or let's say emergency government, but this would be for a short time. But to achieve what they want, it's going to take them lots of casualties from their side. And nobody is sure whether they will be finishing with Hamas, because, you know, Hamas comes from the people. They are Palestinians. They are not brought from outside to live in Gaza.
You just mentioned the sort of saving faces. And to be fair, I want to bring into our conversation the Arab and Muslim countries, for whom I think the Palestinian issue has also become a bit of a token. I mean, they all express their rhetorical solidarity with the Palestinians, but they don't influence the events on the ground or the fair resolution of this crisis. What kind of a reaction, or perhaps a retribution, may we expect from the Arab and Muslim world if indeed the Israeli movement into Gaza proceeds?
Well, I don't believe the Palestinians are hoping too much about the position of the Arab and Muslim governments. But in this respect, we have to notify everybody that what happened, it's called the flood, Al-Aqsa flood. It took it to a religious level. It's not only political, you know. And this sentiment is very much touching for the Muslims worldwide. And by attacking Gaza, I believe people will go to the streets all over the Muslim world, Arab and other Muslim worlds, because not one government can stop them from doing so. Whether this will affect the decision of the Arab governments or Muslim governments, it is something else. But definitely, there should be some repercussions, and such governments will not stay without taking any action. I mean, political, diplomatic, in energy sector, because, you know, the Middle East is full of energy. It has been used in 1973. It could be used once again. These are certain demands by the people themselves. So something is going to happen. They cannot sit and say, we didn't see and we don't see anything of what's going on. Mm-hmm.
Now, in all Israeli-Arab wars until now, Israel prevailed due to its larger army and far better equipped army. And it's clear at this point, as you said, that there are very few, if any, Muslim countries that want to get involved by putting their troops on the ground. But on the other hand, if they don't do anything, they also face a considerable threat, for example, of the influx of Palestinian refugees into Egypt, into Lebanon, into Jordan. That is quite an existential issue. It could threaten or undermine the security of those countries in a very significant way. How do you think they should be dealing with this Gordian knot, on the one hand not wanting to get involved militarily, but also feeling the pressure to do something to prevent, thousands, if not millions, of Palestinian refugees from streaming into their countries?
A few days ago, there was an international summit in Cairo, and this issue was addressed. You know, Egypt is the first country which is connected to Gaza through Rafah passage. And they refuse to open this passage because they don't want any influx of Palestinians into the Egyptian territory. Because if this happens, it means we are finishing all what is related to the Palestinian, you know, issue, which has been going on for the last 75 years. So we are depriving the Palestinian rights and demands for a state, independent state, and what have you. But, you know, they can do so many things. They can use, as I said, diplomatic pressures. They can withdraw. They can call all the ambassadors, especially with these countries, Arabic countries, with which they have exchanged diplomatic relations. They can talk to the Americans in international community. They can exert certain pressure, if not politically, also economically, because they have the means if they know how to use it.
I'm sometimes wondering whether Israel may be playing up this danger of a total takeover of Gaza to essentially pull its Arab neighbors into solving this issue, because as you said, it would be playing into Israel's hands if all the Gaza residents or a significant portion of them flees to the neighboring countries. Israel can move in and take the territory, and you know, judging from the past history, it rarely gives up the territories that it seized militarily. So don't you think that perhaps all this hysteria about the impending invasion of Gaza is a little bit artificial or manipulative in order to essentially encourage Arab and Muslim countries to solve that issue or to draw them in?
Judging on the past of this of Netanyahu, in your time in office as a prime minister, he was all the time refusing to admit to recognize an independent state for the Palestinians. So just to answer you, I don't believe that Israel will be going through this avenue, because they are very much extremist in this case. They will not go for it. They will try. They withdrew from Gaza. I don't think it's the time for them to come again and occupy Gaza. Why they want to take 2 million population more and to care about them from the humanitarian side, security, food, medical, education, so and so. So at this current time, they are again and again they are trying to save the image of the IDF and the government of Israel, because they have freely faced some kind, I cannot say a catastrophe, no. But everybody in this region was saying that they have the best army in this region. This best army and all the intelligence services that they have failed to detect or to anticipate what was going on. So now they are cornered. But if somebody is in a corner, he can inflict damage on himself and on others. And that's what they are doing.
Yeah, I think we essentially agree here that they are cornered by their own arrogance in believing that they can control the situation only by force, when in fact we are talking about millions and millions of people who have been put in under very undignified conditions for decades. And that problem, no one can...
Sorry, force does not solve solutions. I mean, issues like this. If we go back all over the history, at the end of the day, there should be a diplomatic solution, political solution. People have to sit together around the table and discuss things and address it in a very realistic way. The only realistic way is to have two independent states. We have UN resolutions, which are adopted, accepted by the international community. We have the quadrat, which is where Russia, United States, European Union, and United Nations are existing. They should work together to implement, to reach and implement a political solution. And I wonder now if both sides will accept it at this current time. But at the end of the day, we should have a political solution.
Mr. Zaid, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will go back to this discussion in a few seconds. Please stay tuned.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Amal Abu Zeib, former member of the Lebanese parliament and advisor to former Lebanese president Michel Aoun. Mr. Zeib, before the break, we started talking about historical lessons. And I know that throughout your lifetime, you've been a very active member of the Maronite community of Lebanon. It's a Christian ethno-religious group that has been able to preserve its collective identity throughout centuries without having its own state. And I think its example is very relevant for the current Israeli-Palestinian context, because ultimately they are also fighting over land, over statehood, over collective identity. And a question I want to ask you is, what do you think has allowed the Maronites to develop as a people all the way from the fourth century without having this protective and unifying structure of a state?
First of all, because Maronites, you know, they are Christians, as you just said, very much believers in Christianity. And at that time, you know, the whole region around it, it was actually distributed among many many factions and many empires, you know. But throughout the years, we have maintained our own, let's say, interest among the Orient, because you know we live in Lebanon and we are scattered not only in Lebanon, in Lebanon, in Palestine, in Syria, in Jordan, and some other also areas. So we are spread all over these countries. We have a good relation with all the other communities who we all together lived in peace, really in real peace, with the where every community, every ethnic group is having its own rights of belief, its own rights of self-determination, if, political rights as well, until we reached the point after the French mandate that we worked with the others living in this surrounding, especially in the Lebanon that we know today, with our Muslim also brothers here, to form a country which is called Lebanon, where every ethnic group has its own rights preserved politically, you know, religiously, educationally, and legally. So it's a practice that we have lived this throughout the years, and we still maintain.
Speaking about national identities, I think it's more or less clear what Israel stands for. But what about the Palestinians? Do you think they carry any distinct national identity apart from their resistance to Israel's domination? And is resistance alone to sustain a collective or national identity?
I think they have their own identity, which is clear, the Palestinian identity. And after all, if I may say, because of all what's happened throughout this 75 years or more, a Muslim identity is very important as well for them, because most of them are Muslims. They belong to a majority in this Orient, as we say. So yes, they have their own identity, whether it's collective or not. It is part of the, if I may say, if I permit myself to say, of the Sunni world, which they are considered as part of them, and because they have Jerusalem and Al-Aqsa Mosque over there. So yes, they are connected, and they have this kind of identity.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned your belief that this two-state solution is the only viable scenario. And to some extent, paying lip service to the two-state solution has allowed Israel to maintain this very unjust status quo for many, many decades. And I'm sure you've heard that some people are suggesting to keep things as they are, that is sort of quasi one state, but press for equal rights for all, perhaps adopt the Lebanese model that you just mentioned, where, you know, Christians and Shia and Sunni Muslims can live side by side, as well as some other groups like Druze, for example. Why do you think the two-state solution is still a better option, given, again, the current realities and how much the situation on the ground has changed over the past 75 years or so?
The answer is because the Israeli state is announced as a state for Jews. It's very simple, because they say it. I'm not saying it. So even if you have the 1948 Arabs living there, I wonder if they have all rights as the other Israelis living there or the other Jews living there. So, no, you know, there are certain differences. Okay, there was a solution of one state whereby Palestinians, Jews are living together and under the same flag, as we say, with sharing the same identity. But still, I don't think it's a viable solution because of all what happened. In our case, as Lebanon, we didn't have this kind of atrocities between ourselves. Okay, we had the civil war, 1975, and that was instigated by foreign interferences because of the Palestinian issue, because of the presence of the Palestinians in Lebanon, to be more precise. They wanted to solve the issue of Palestine or at the expense of the Lebanese, to be the country for the Palestinians. So other than that, no, we are living in peace. Okay, we have our differences, like everywhere, all over the world. We have differences in the same community, but this does not push us into going to arms and fight. So it's different, the example between Lebanon and Israel. No.
Well, it may be different, but I think that example of the Israeli intervention in Lebanon back in the mid-1980s is also a relevant one because, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think their efforts to eradicate the PLO bases has actually led to the consolidation and empowerment of Hezbollah. So even if they succeed in removing or significantly undermining Hamas, do you think they can fully deal with this bigger problem of an armed resistance to their policies? Because they seem to be chasing not the actual group, but this whole idea that the opposition to the way they're occupying the Holy Land, it seems to be much broader than or much deeper than just one insurgent group. What do you think?
Yeah, it's what you are saying is correct. I believe even when you talk now about the eradication of the PLO from Lebanon, but did this eradication stop PLO from existing as a political body or as a military arm? No, it did not. Even if they manage control Gaza, but this doesn't mean that they will also eradicate Hamas. So it means that the use of force is not the proper answer to all the questions, to all the issues and differences and problems that we are facing. Mm-hmm. We have to look to another angle.
There's one more question I want to ask you. Whenever we deal with a major international issue these days, there are always two ways of looking at it. One that allows for the presence of a historical context and one that seeks to eliminate it. And I think both the Israelis and the Americans clearly prefer the latter option. You know, they're focusing now all their attention on the brutality of Hamas and refusing to recognize that this brutality didn't occur out of nowhere. It grew from the suppression of legitimate rights of certain people. And I wonder, how would you approach this very intricate problem of historical realities and the actual realities? Because we need to rectify some historical injustices, but also with some semblance of respect to the current day events.
Well, I can give you our own experience in that. So since 1948, when the Palestinian crisis, you know, came to international arena, as we say, Lebanon has been facing the enmity of Israel, the attacks of Israel. We have paid very high prices. Several times they attacked Lebanon. We paid the civilian prices, economical prices, and during all these events that occurred, we never had any support or any, let's say, kind of Western, not only American, I'm talking about the whole West, to sympathize with us as Lebanese, or to sympathize with our casualties. Every time we are on the defense, and we were attacked, and they were all the time supporting Israel with all what it was doing. So this gives you an example. It's historical. It's been like this, and today, nowadays, of all what they said, all what they mentioned, with the videos that they have broadcasted about what Hamas did, turned to be not true. Look what's happening every single day, every hour, every minute of the day, the continuous bombardment to the people in Gaza. What is this? Is it human? And we cannot see hear any denouncement from America or other parts of the West. Mm-hmm. We are against war, but sometimes you are put in a position, you have to defend yourself and to defend your rights. You are a human being, you have the right to exist, to breathe, to live in dignity, as, mm-hmm. as you said before. So, well, I cannot comment more than this, because we had enough, and we have enough from the Western side.
And I want to mention here the experience of my colleague here, Darty, one of our cameramen. He is originally from Palestine, and just last week, an Israeli bomb hit the house where his family was living, and more than 12 members of his family are dead in one single moment. So, I'm sure there are, you know, people all over the world who can either sympathize or be directly affected by this crisis. And the worst thing about it, I remember this colleague, like some 10 years ago, we were traveling around the Middle East. I think we were in Syria, and he told me that, look, you as a Russian with no connection to Israel, you can go there anytime. You can get a visa, you can travel the holy places. And I, as somebody who was born in Palestine, cannot go there. And, you know, that says something about, you know, the very, it's not even dignity. It's like something very existential for many Palestinians who have been denied the right to be themselves, actually. I mean, Israel always claims the right to protect itself, but it's doing it at the cost of other people's right of existence.
Derooting. They were derooted. Do you know what it means? It's very hard. You know, I was living in Lebanon during the civil war and during the attacks of the Israelis, especially 2006. You know what it means to move from your village, another village, live in shelter. We have witnessed this. Others, Palestinians, are witnessing the same. And I think after all what's happening, the international world has to wake up. Let me say that we have to say to open its eyes, its ears, and to take the stand and to stop all these atrocities made by the Israelis. They have to put an end to it.
Well, Mr. Zaid, I hope they hear it at least, but... let me thank you for sharing your insights with us today, and let's hope that as many lives could be saved as possible in this very, very difficult and very, very long conflict.
I join you in hoping this, actually, because we have enough. When people are having enough, really, that's too much.
Okay, thank you for watching, and hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.